Welcome to Big Blue Kickoff Live on this Thursday afternoon. John Schmelk and Lance Mehta with you. A special edition, three interviews today. We usually take your calls. Today we will not. We'll do a couple of game previews. But first, our big interview off the top is former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi. And Ernie found out earlier this week that he'll be heading into the Giants Ring of Honor at MetLife Stadium in a ceremony taking place on November 14th. Monday night against the Bengals, and he joins us on Big Blue Kickoff Live today. Ernie, John Schmelk, Lance Mehta here in East Rutherford. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be on with you.
What does it mean to have your name up there with all those other Giants legends in the Ring of Honor?
It's overwhelming. I've been in a lot of stadiums over the years where they have these Rings of Honor, and mostly they're players. In fact, they're almost all players and coaches. I never even dreamed that I would ever be up there, let alone with this franchise. And, you know, I agree with Tuck and Coughlin when they said this is the best organization in sports. I always tell the young guys that I worked with the Giants, I said, I'm fortunate that my last job was with this organization. If you guys don't stay with them, you're going to find out there is no other organization like this. And it's just it's a great honor. I mean, I'm a pretty old guy, and I grew up following sports starting in the 50s and saw this team the first time in 1952. So to be able to have my name up there with such great people like Frank Gifford and Charles Connolly and Lawrence Taylor, it's overwhelming to me.
Ernie, as you mentioned, you've been part of a few organizations throughout the course of your career, and what's unique about the Giants is, you know, they do such a good job of recognizing their history and emphasizing that, and, you know, the fact that you're going to be the second general manager in franchise history to be in the Ring of Honor, along with one of the guys that you worked under in George Young. I mean, how does that really put things in perspective in terms of your career?
Well, that, you know, it's extra special to be up there with George because we first met. He joined the Baltimore Colts in 69. I joined in 1970. We were both making $14,000 a year. He was a scout. I was a PR director, although we all scouted because we only had five people in the organization. Even the equipment manager scouted. But to have started with him and have been so close to him over the years, and to be one of two general managers in this franchise's history, where both of us got our starts with the Colts. And you're right about the history. I mean, there's the continuity is Wellington Mara's father, John Mara's grandfather, started this franchise in 1925. And then it went to Wellington and then to John. And there's been a great partnership with the Tisch family since 1990. I mean, it hasn't changed hands. And the other two franchises I worked with were both historical, the Baltimore Colts and the Cleveland Browns, but they both moved. You know, there is no Baltimore Colts anymore. There's the Cleveland Browns, but it's not the same franchise. So this one just is, you know, it's the flagship franchise. And I always felt that way. And, you know, even when I didn't work here and really didn't have a lot of hope that I ever would, but to be – to work here is a privilege to be recognized like this. You know, it's I didn't dream that dream. I mean, I wouldn't let myself dream that dream. So it's really a wonderful moment for me.
We're joined by Ernie Accorsi right here on Big Blue Kickoff Live on Giants.com. And Ernie, you talked about the continuity. So does it really make it almost fitting that the two guys going into the Ring of Honor the same year you are two guys that you had a hand in bringing to the Giants and really helped carry through the legacy that you put together as general manager, putting those two Super Bowl championships together?
That makes it even better. There's so many parts of this that are just terrific, and that makes it even better. I exchanged emails or texts with Tom Coughlin yesterday, and I said to him, did you ever think when we sat at the Newark Airport Marriott in 2004, that winter when we interviewed John Mara and I interviewed him, that it would come to this? I mean, you know, you hope it's going to come to this, but he hadn't won a championship yet, and I hadn't either. I mean, I had as a PR director, but not as a general manager. So, Tuck was such a great pick for us because, you know, the only reason he was available when he was available is because he was injured and he played hurt. He was a first-round player. And so to be involved, you know, to go in with them, it makes it even better.
Talking with former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi here on Big Blue Kickoff Live on Giants.com. You talked about that meeting that you had with Tom Coughlin, Ernie, and when you look at his career overall with the New York Giants, I think what's interesting is when you first brought him in as a head coach, you know, his resume, his reputation, the way he interacted with the media, and then at the end of his career, you know, how much really he changed and evolved as a head coach. You know, talk about what you observed both when you were within the organization and from afar, and how impressed you are with how Tom really changed his overall approach to coaching during his tenure with the Giants.
Well, first of all, and I think this is the most important thing, he's a great man. He's got integrity. He's a family man. He's a religious man. So he's a good person. Secondly, he caught my eye. I didn't know much about him when he was an assistant coach. I saw one of his first games at Boston College when he almost beat Michigan. It's the day I saw Tyrone Wheatley, who made and Desmond Howard had to return a kickoff to beat him. And he didn't really have an abundance of talent. And I watched the job he did as a head coach there. And, of course, he took Jacksonville to the brink of a championship awful fast. So I knew he could coach. But the interesting thing, and you'll remember this, when we hired him, there was a lot of criticism and you know, from some quarters that, oh, you're never going to get any players in free agency. Nobody will come here and play for him. And I will tell you this, we never really lost a free agent we really wanted. So, in his era. So it didn't happen. And players that want to win are going to want to play for a guy like that. Because he's a winner, he's demanding. Players want to win. They want the discipline. So, yeah, he did. You know, after I left, I mean, I guess I wasn't there, so I'm no expert on everything. But you know, he evolved, and I mean, Belichick changed. I hired Belichick, and you know, and things didn't work out in Cleveland right away. Although I think they would have if they wouldn't have been in all that turmoil of the move. I think he's just going to win no matter where he goes. But he adapted, he changed, and you know, the great ones will do that. The ones that don't succeed keep making the same mistakes. And I think that's one of the great joys of Tom Coughlin. He's smart, and he revised, but he didn't change his principles. He didn't change his basic fundamentals.
You know, Ernie, you came in, you succeeded George Young in 1998. You had Danny Cannell as your starting quarterback, and I guess really the first super big decision you had to make was a decision to bring in Kerry Collins, which obviously eventually paid dividends. It got the Giants to that Super Bowl a couple years later. Can you take us through what that decision-making process was like for you, deciding that Kerry Collins was a good fit for the Giants, given everything that had gone on with him in Carolina?
Yes, first of all, you know, I have a lot of people share this, but when I first came into the league, Johnny Unitas was the quarterback that I was involved with. Now, so I was spoiled for life. And I also knew, as that team evolved from being world champions in the late 50s, the one that played the Giants in the sudden death game, to not quite as good a team, although we won the Super Bowl in 70, it wasn't as talented, his supporting cast, but we always had him. And what I learned is that when you have a great quarterback, you always have a chance. And I always defined leadership is looking on the team bus on the road when you always have a few more butterflies than you do at home and seeing that guy, and you know he's on our side, he's got a chance. So when I inherited the job, Danny Cannell was a fine quarterback, but I've always believed that position is the most important position in sports, and, you know, there wasn't one available in the draft. We couldn't just go draft one. And when he became available, what we did with our organization is we went back to all our reports that we had when he came out. I also had an advantage that I had worked for Paterno, and I trusted the Penn State people. And there were mostly the coaches that were there when we signed Kerry had coached him. And I knew he had solid character. He went off the track, but I knew that his background, and he's from Lebanon, Pennsylvania, which was 10 miles from where I grew up. So I had contacts all through there, and I remember when Bill Pennington did this huge takeout piece in the Times on him, he told me he went back there, talked to his high school coach, his junior high school coach. He said, everybody I talked to said that you had already talked to them. I mean, we really researched it, and we felt that he had the character, that he was going to be fine. And I told him when I interviewed him, I said, you're going to find that the Giants organization is the closest thing you'll ever come to Penn State. It's professional football. It's not collegiate football. But this is a family here. And that's the way it's run. And you'll get all the support measures you need, but you're going to have to do it yourself. We never had a problem with him. He played well. He got us to the Super Bowl. But I still felt that we had to reach for greatness if we could. And I talked to Jerry Reese. There were rumors that Eli was going to come out his junior year. And I went down to see him against Auburn. And I came up, and he didn't come out. But when I wrote that report now that's gone viral, and I essentially thought we can win a championship with this guy. And when he did come out, I really, you know, the fortunate thing for us is that we had that year in 2003 to put us in fourth spot. If I wouldn't have been in the fourth spot, we wouldn't have gotten him. We would have had to go too far to get him. Now, you know, I would have been satisfied with Roethlisberger. I felt very, really good about Roethlisberger. And all our scouts did, Tom did, the Maras did. We felt real solid about Roethlisberger, but I just, and they're about as close as you can get as far as what they've done. But it was just something about Eli that he was the one I wanted, but I didn't really expect to get him at that point because it looked like they weren't going to trade him. Or they were asking for OC Unum and Euro, which we were not going to give him. So that's how the whole thing evolved, because I just felt that with the quarterback, you have to reach for greatness if you have a chance.
Well, you just mentioned a lot about that 2004 quarterback class, Ernie, and Philip Rivers, who obviously was part of the Eli Manning trade. And it's interesting because now when we look back, we tend to put that class in perspective. A lot of people who want to debate which quarterback class is the greatest bring in the 83 class too, which you also have ties to. Now, on the subject of trying to coordinate a trade with A.J. Smith, who was the Chargers general manager at the time, your experience dealing with John Elway and what happened in 83 with the Colts, how much did that help in terms of orchestrating the deal and understanding perhaps what San Diego was going through with Eli Manning?
Well, I didn't know AJ. I walked up to him at the league meetings in March, and it already kind of surfaced that Eli didn't want to play out there. And I went up to him and introduced myself. I said, look, we're fourth. I went through this. It was a little different because Elway had this baseball leverage that I never believed in, because I had a scouting report, and you know he was a prospect, but he was going to play football, and I said, but if you want to see this through, and don't flinch at this, I'm all for it because I did it, and I defied the odds, I faced all the protests, I did it, so God bless you if that's what you're going to do, but if you want to trade him, we're interested. Now, I only spoke to him three or four times after that, but the interesting thing about that is when you can't pick a player for another team, that's not allowed by the league. So if I called the league before I drafted Rivers, we were going to draft Roethlisberger, and AJ called me 7 minutes into our 15-minute allotment. Had we jumped and drafted Roethlisberger, that would have been the end of it because he didn't want Roethlisberger, he wanted Rivers. But if I would have called the league and said, look, will you certify this trade? I'm going to pick Rivers, but I'm going to trade him. They would have said no. If you pick Rivers and he backs out of the trade, you have Rivers. Now, I like Rivers, but that was a big risk by us because we were picking Roethlisberger. So when AJ called, he asked for OC again. I said no. And then he said, would you give me next year's number one? I said yes, because we had already discussed that. But I said, who do you want? And he said, Rivers. I held my breath. Okay? Because he could have backed out and the league would have backed him. Because the league would not accept that. You're not allowed to do that. I mean, I didn't break any rule, but you're not allowed to get approved by the league in advance. So
right, yeah.
I held my breath. And then, Joel Busser talked to both of us. Our terms agreed. They were consistent. And he accepted it even before the computer message got in. But that certified it.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's, yeah. That has to be a level of trust there between general managers and organizations. And the funny thing is, general managers hate trading draft picks. They don't like trading ones. It really puts you in a bind in next year. But ironically, you trade the number one from 2005 to get Eli, and then the 2005 draft class turns out, quite frankly, to be a fantastic draft class for the New York Football Giants. You bring in
I know, and that,
Webster,
and
Tuck,
amazing.
And Brandon Jacobs. It's amazing.
Well, we we had four picks, you know, and actually the fourth pick was a defensive lineman who was a pretty good player. We were trying to keep him, but I was in the back of a elevator coming down. You know, the stadium changed where when you left the press box, you were in the with the suite holders,
right?
And we were getting bombed by the Packers the first year I was retired, the people didn't recognize me. I was in the back of the elevator, and I heard these guys talking about, this was before that year. This was before the Eli's rookie year. I heard him saying, "Now we only have four picks next year, and now this quarterback's a bust." And I was shrinking against. I was thinking, "Please don't turn around, because I don't want to face the music."
Oh, man.
And I ran from my car when I got out of that. But that was I was actually during Eli's rookie year when we were losing. But that turned out to be. I think that those three guys were indispensable to our titles. I don't know that we would have won without those three guys.
Absolutely.
Talking with former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. He'll be inducted into the Giants Ring of Honor, the second general manager. That'll come week 10 when the Giants host the Bengals on Monday Night Football. And the exact date is November 14th, so certainly stay tuned for that with Tom Coughlin and Justin Tuck. You mentioned that 2005 draft class, Ernie, and you also mentioned earlier that during the Tom Coughlin era, you didn't miss out any of free agency in terms of when you pursued some of the notable players. And when I look at the players you brought in, I think Antonio Pierce really, to me, jumps off the page, especially with what he provided for the team and helping them win Super Bowls, but also the leadership he brought to the locker room. What was the rationale in targeting Antonio Pierce? And when you look back at what ultimately his career became with the Giants, how impressed are you in terms of with the results?
See, I agree with you completely. His leadership, I mean, he was everything you wanted. He wasn't a holler guy, but one of the keys to that signing was Marty Schottenheimer. He had coached 1 year for the Redskins, and he played him outside, and he got fired. And, you know, we liked Pierce. Dave Gettleman was incredible as a pro personnel guy. To me, he didn't make one mistake in evaluations while I was there. And we talked about him, but we wanted a guy to play the middle. And I called Marty, and I asked him about it. He said, and I didn't even ask him. He said to me, "I made a mistake with him. I should have played him in the middle." He said, "He was good outside. He has a chance to be an outstanding middle linebacker." And I trusted Marty because I had worked with Marty. And that was the rationale. I agree with you. I thought that he and Plexico were the huge signings. And with Plexico, you know, we needed Eli to have somebody he could go to and get out of trouble. Where he was rushed, he could just throw it downfield, and he was like a rebounder. And he could out-jump people and had great hands. And I knew we had to get a great receiver. Toomer was terrific. Hilliard was terrific. But we needed to get a big play receiver who could make the errant throw into a big play. So those two were huge to us. And the leadership of Antonio, though, I agree, he was such a quiet leader. And, you know, I remember sitting with him on a Saturday before the Super Bowl in Arizona, just the two of us, and then Armstead came up and sat down with us. Armstead said something to him, "How do you feel?" He said, "I'm starting to get nervous." This was the day before the game. And he said, "But I'm going to do is go over my assignments and just study my assignments again tonight and try to stay within myself." But of course, you know, the rest is history from that game.
You know, Ernie, it's funny. You talk about two of those big free agent additions in Pierce and Plaxico, but I think the key to these championships sometimes is figuring out a way to acquire talent without using premium resources. And I think the way you guys put together that offensive line, that was so important to that run. Yeah, Kareem McKenzie was a relatively big free agent addition, used a high draft pick on Chris Knee, but finding Richie Seibert, finding Sean O'Hara, finding David Deal, and that unit just working so well together, I think that group and the way you put them together was as indispensable as anybody else on that roster putting that run together.
I agree. And those are, listen, if we didn't protect Eli, we wouldn't have won. And that line was okay for a while and got great. And Flaherty did a great job with that line. But you're right, Sean O'Hara was a great signing. Soybert coming back from his injuries. David Deal, you know, when we drafted him, we thought probably play guard, maybe play right tackle. They had the courage to play him at left tackle. Yeah. We won two Super Bowls with a guy at left tackle. I always learned, be careful and don't overevaluate individuals in the offensive line because they're like a fist. If you make a fist and you take one of the fingers out, you're not going to be able to be as effective no matter what you do. They have to work together as a unit. And boy, that line was, they were tough mentally and physically, and they worked together, and they were like glue. They were so close. You're right. The one pedigree was Chris Snee. We knew he was. But it was such a combination of different personalities and different levels of talent. But as a unit, they played great together.
When it comes to scouting players for the draft as well as free agency, as you noted throughout this interview, Ernie, you need a team of people. And, you know, the Giants have a track record. You were going over the history earlier in the program in terms of ownership and growing people within. You know, two individuals in particular that served under you, Dave Gettleman, who you referenced earlier, and Jerry Reese, who ultimately succeeded you as Giants general manager. When you look at what they've accomplished after you groom them, Gettleman going on to helping the Panthers get to the most recent Super Bowl, Jerry Reese, the two Super Bowls in 07 and 11. Now, how meaningful is that for you personally when you've worked alongside those two individuals, you help get them opportunities, and then you see how they took what they learned under you and ultimately applied that moving forward?
Well, and it's really interesting, the evolution of both of those two guys. And I've said that to both of them, that I just said it to Dave last year when we went to the Super Bowl. This sounds like a phony statement. I was as happy for Gettleman as I would have been for myself. I felt the same thing about Jerry. Jerry was an area scout in Tennessee. I saw very quickly in the draft that just as a scout, I thought he was our best scout. And when Tim Rooney abruptly retired, I was really shocked that he was my age and I wasn't, you know, he was able to retire. He had worked at Villanova when I was at St. Joe's, and when he came in, he says, "I'm going to retire." I said, "One thing's for sure, the Augustinian order paid better than the Jesuits." I said, "How can you afford to retire? You're 59. So, but anyway, when that happened, we elevated Gettleman from assistant to the number one job, and I called Jerry and I said, "I want you to come up here because I want you to be the assistant pro guy." And he came up, and the first thing he got was sticker shock. He saw the prices of houses. Now, he had a beautiful house in rural Tennessee, and I was afraid he wasn't going to take it. I said, "You have to take this job. You're going to be a general manager someday, but you're not going to be a general manager if you continue to stay as an area scout. You got to come back into the office. You got to be able to dress up, come in, learn the disciplines and structure of the office. You got to get here. Follow the job. The money will catch up." And thankfully, he took it. So then when Marv left, I made him player personnel director. So we had the two of them there. But I also don't want to overlook the fact that if you look at that scouting staff, there's been very, very little turnover. Yeah. Because they've stayed there. Of course, it's a great organization to work for. They've been good scouts. We've kept them. Our scouts were fans. People retire like Jerry Shea, but people don't leave. And I remember when I took over, there was a guy named Joe Collins that was with the 49ers, then he went to the Browns.
He's still here, Ernie.
I know that, but my point is that he had all that experience with Bill Walsh. And it's interesting, he made a report in 1980 as a Blestow scout, and it was the Blestow meetings were in Baltimore, and he gave his reports and then left because he was joining the Jets. And I said to myself, I'm going to hire that guy someday. And I always watched him. And when I hired him, he said, "What do you want from me?" I said, "Well, I want you to be a great scout." I said, "But I want a man in that draft room because we had so many young kids in there because we expanded our scouting staff." I said, "Well, I want a leader in there. I want a guy that they can look up to." And boy, he was that. And, you know, when things got kind of, you know, how they will in debates and in the draft room and meetings, not the day of the draft, but I'm talking about as you prepare, he put things in order pretty quickly. And there's a perfect example where we didn't go outside very often. We trained our own scouts, but when we did go outside for somebody like him, it was a 10 strike.
Hollywood is great. We love him. I always talk to him when we go out to the combine, and he is a amount of football knowledge that you need books to put on paper. He's unbelievable. We're joined by Ernie Accorsi, former Giants general manager. Two more quickies, Ernie, before we say goodbye. Thank you so much for being patient with your time here. A couple of the Super Bowls you had your fingerprints on. You know, you take a look back, and I don't want to bring up a sore subject, but you look at the Super Bowl against the Ravens, you look at the score, and you say, wow, you know, domination, it looked like a blowout. But when you go back and you look at that game, the final score, irregardless, that really seemed to me a game that the Giants were in and competitive in and had a real shot in despite what the final score might have looked like at the end of the game. Do you agree?
Absolutely, and I tell you why. If they don't call Armstead's touchdown back, we're in the game.
Keith Hamilton holding penalty.
a phantom call, which they never make, let alone in the Super Bowl. But I'll tell you why I believe that, and I don't mean to demean Dilfer. He won, okay, but they didn't even keep him. When I was in my first Super Bowl, Super Bowl V, the only reason we won that game is because Craig Morton gave it to us. I mean, we got to the goal line twice on four plays and could not get in. He comes right back and throws an interception. And the fact is that that could have happened to Dilfer if that interception would have been returned for a touchdown. Because John Fox told me the week of the game, he said, you know, that he had already told me we're going to shut out Minnesota, which I thought he was nuts when he told me that, because they scored about 1,000 points in my dreams during the night of that week.
Oh, they were good.
Yeah, exactly. But he said to me, we're going to shut these people out. I mean, you know, they didn't have much of them. They couldn't score. If we would have, you know, it would have put a lot of pressure on Dilfer for the rest of that game. But I will tell you the one thing I learned, a great lesson in that Super Bowl. We weren't good enough. And I knew that the one thing that we had to do is reach for greatness at quarterback, but we had to get a better pass rush. And those are the two things. You're not going to win championships without those two things. You might get lucky like they did that year, because they say lucky. It's one of the greatest defenses in history. But, you know, we threw five interceptions. And I knew that when I looked at that team, we weren't good enough. We had to get better than that. And that's how you learn in this business. You don't kid yourself into thinking, oh, we could have won this game. Well, yeah, we could have. We could have stolen it, but we didn't. But I don't want to steal it. I want to be good enough to win in our own right.
Well, and you followed through with those core principles, Ernie. You got Eli Manning and then the likes of Justin Tuck and OCU Mignore to help with the pass rush. So the core that you ultimately helped build goes on to win Super Bowls in 07 and 11 after seeing what transpired in that previous Super Bowl and then seeing what you built and them achieving greatness. You know, how meaningful, how special was it to then watch to see what this group ultimately accomplished?
It was fabulous. I mean, it was I can't even explain how I felt that at that Arizona Super Bowl. I sat with my son, who was a coach. My oldest son coached at, he was a GA in Virginia, and then he was a full-time coach at Maryland. And when we got the ball on the last drive, and I've said this before, I was hoping he was going to take us for a touchdown. The second Super Bowl, I felt they're not going to stop us. I didn't feel as confident the first time, but I said to my son, I said, well, if Eli's what we thought he was, he does it right now. This is when you have to do it. This is when Unitas did it. Not October 15th, now. And he did. He did. I mean, it was really hard to explain the feeling I had when he hit. And I give Coughlin so much credit, because in the back of my mind, I thought playoff substitutes in the last regular season game. Don't take any chance of getting anybody hurt. He played that game to win, and I am convinced that team came out of that game thinking, they're not that good, we can beat them. I'm convinced of it. And Coughlin was right, 100% right on that. And by playing them tough, we weren't afraid of them when we got into the Super Bowl.
And Ernie, finally, final question, and again, thanks so much for joining us. People forget, and I'm sure it's going to be lost to history, but if you were in this city in the middle of 2007, after that Minnesota Viking game, I believe it was at the end of November, I mean, half this town wanted to run Eli Manning out on a train and get him out of town. And, you know, if he doesn't have that last drive against the Patriots, the Giants only scored 10 points in the Super Bowl. I'm sure people will forget then the unbelievable performance he had against the Packers the previous week. You know, just that drive, you know, really cemented Eli Manning's status as the future franchise quarterback of the Giants to where he is today. And I think people will forget, you know, how tenuous it really was at times during that 2007 season.
Well, I'll tell you this. I was at that Viking game. And you know, he threw an interception and I left. By the time I got to the car, he had thrown another one. By the time I got to the Lincoln Tunnel, he threw another one. And when I came out of the Lincoln Tunnel, he threw another one. I mean, I wanted to just hide somewhere. Yeah. You know, but it's interesting. You know, one of the first lessons I learned from a guy named Milt Davis, he died a few years ago, was one of his scouts in Baltimore. I had not seen Unitas because I was at Penn State for 2 years. I hadn't seen him in person, and he had torn all the tendons in his elbow. And he was throwing softballs in training camp. And I, you know, what did I know? I was a rookie. And I said, can we win with him? And he said, remember one thing, Ernest. You evaluate a quarterback with his ability to take a team down the field in the championship game with the title on the line and into the end zone. That's how you evaluate a quarterback. And, you know, you can throw interceptions. You can do whatever. If you can do that, then you're going to be a championship quarterback.
And Eli Manning certainly
indeed
proved that he is on more than one occasion. Ernie, thanks so much. We appreciate the time, and we look forward to seeing you at the stadium on November 14th when you're inducted into the Giants Ring of Honor on Monday Night Football along with Tom Coughlin and Justin Tuck. Congratulations again, and we'll talk to you down the road. Okay?
Congrats, Ernie.
Well,
thanks so much
for having me, guys. I enjoyed it.
That's former Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi, and now we turn our attention back to the Giants schedule. The next game up is their game on November 20th when the Giants host the Chicago Bears. And joining us to talk about it is Adam Johns from the Chicago Sun-Times. He covers the Chicago Bears. Adam, you got John Schmelk and Lance Meadow here in East Rutherford, New Jersey. How are you today?
Good, fellas. How are you guys?
Hey, we're doing fantastic, and all the fun starts next week. Players report to training camp. This party gets started. I got to imagine that after a year, which I guess you would consider a rebuilding year for the Bears, hopes must be pretty high that maybe they might be able to make a playoff push this year.
Yeah, here's the thing. The Bears hired John Fox for his quick turnaround. He did it in Carolina. He did it in Denver. But to me, there's a big difference between the situation in Denver and the situation with the Bears right now. And Peyton Manning is not coming out of retirement to save the Bears and to really be a difference maker like he was for Fox in year two in Denver, where they really became a Super Bowl contender. So I got Jay Cutler here. The Bears believe in him. But you've got a lot of turnover on this roster. Like, on paper, I think the defense is going to be better. The front seven is a lot better with Danny Trevathan and Jarrell Freeman at inside linebacker. But on offense, you lost Martellus Bennett. You traded him away to the Patriots. Matt Forte is now playing for the New York Jets. You have a lot of question marks about the options and the playmakers you have on offense right now.
Well, Adam, speaking of that, let's start with offense. And first of all, you mentioned Peyton Manning's not coming out of nowhere. They do have Jay Cutler, and they did not draft a quarterback, but they did bring in Brian Hoyer as insurance. And Cutler, we know, has always had some questions about durability. But in fairness, he's coming off a solid season. When you look at his numbers, how much do you think this offense, though, is going to change now that Adam Gase is no longer the offensive coordinator? He's now the head coach of the Dolphins. I know they did promote the quarterback's coach, Dwayne Loggins, but how much do you think maybe the offense could be tweaked with a new face running things?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of new faces with this offense. I think Dwayne Loggins will change some certain things from Adam Gase. The overall language is going to remain the same. You've got to figure out his offensive line. You have Kevin White coming back, you know, the first-round pick from a couple of years ago. You have some questions about the backfield, who's filling in for Forte. But in terms of Cutler's relationship with this Bears team right now, they showed a lot of faith in him by promoting Loggins instead of going, you know, elsewhere, whether it was bringing a Wisenhunt or someone like that from the outside. Loggins is a Cutler guy. Cutler, they're starting to build more around Cutler now as opposed to where Cutler had to win them over last year. I'm talking about Ryan Pace and John Fox. They needed to be convinced of what Cutler could be for this team out and off the field. Now they're believers. The best sign of that is promoting Dow Loggins from quarterback coach to offensive coordinator to keep that offensive continuity. They're preaching that. But still, there's so many question marks around Cutler. at this point. Dow Loggins had a lot of things to figure out. But this team does believe in Jay Cutler. Even the Brian Hoyer move is a sign of their faith in Jay Cutler. They think he could be a good guy to have in the quarterback group to give him advice and just be a guy to bounce off things off of. But Cutler, by his success last year, the career high passer rating, all the low turnover rate, all those good things he did last year, he's really increased expectations for himself for this season.
And in terms of the targets he'll be throwing the football to, Alshon Jeffrey's back on the franchise tag. They weren't able to figure out a long-term deal, which is fine. You know, they'll figure that out next year. And then you have Kevin White, who I really think could be an X factor. He sat it all year last year with that stress fracture in his leg. Do you think he's a little bit further ahead than a typical quote-unquote rookie would be? This is going to be basically his rookie year. Because he was around the team last year and was maybe able to at least absorb some of the offense, or was he really starting from scratch this offseason? Is it going to take him a little bit while to get into the groove here in this Bears offense?
Well, you think he should be ahead because he was around so much. He even traveled with the Bears later in the season last year to get the vibe and the feel for how the travel schedule worked. I mean, that was part of Ryan Pace's philosophy and plan for him. But I tell you what, from Adam Gase leaving for the Dolphins, from Mike Groh, the receivers coach, leaving for the Rams, there's some changes that, in terms of the instructions and the person he's getting it from, that's different for Kevin White. And look, there's some benefits to watching and learning from a chalkboard and watching the film and stuff, but nothing replaces being on the field and actually running these routes. One of the concerns of Kevin White was that limited route tree he's had at West Virginia. That concern still exists right now. New receivers coach Curtis Johnson is on Kevin White's case. He was on his case throughout OTAs. He was on his case throughout veteran minicamp. Yes, he is a physical, special talent. I mean, he has size. He has speed. He is ripped beyond belief. He is a physical specimen. But in terms of learning the finer details of being an NFL receiver, you can still see that Kevin White is a work in progress. Now, things could be different when they face the Giants. But for right now, we're in July. Kevin White is clearly still learning on the job for the Bears right now.
Absolutely, and a lot of time till they do play the Giants because they're not going to meet Chicago until Week 11. It's part of a three-game homestand for the Giants that late in the season. We're talking with Adam Johns, who covers the Bears for the Chicago Sun-Times. Earlier, Adam, you alluded to the tight end position, and Martellus Bennett was shipped out to New England. And one guy who emerged was Zach Miller last season, but it was really his coming out party if you look at his career and you look at his statistical numbers. How sold is the team on Miller that he can duplicate his success from last season? And what does the depth chart look like beyond Miller now that you're trying to fill the void left behind by Martellus Bennett?
Well, let's go to the depth chart, fellas. Let me know if you know these names. Rob Housler, Kari Lee. I mean, those are your top backups right now. Ben Broniker, an undrafted free agent signing out of Harvard, has a really good chance to make this team with how thin the Bears are at tight end right now. Look, they had to get rid of Martellus Bennett for a lot of different reasons. He just didn't fit in well with the culture they're building with John Fox. He just rubbed a lot of players, a lot of coaches and staff members the wrong way with his actions over the past 3 years or so years that he was here for the Bears. But there is a physical talent. There is a production void that has been left by Martellus Bennett's departure. Yes, Zach Miller can fill some of that. Hey, Cutler likes him. Now Logan likes him. He fits that football character that John Fox always preaches about. But the guy hasn't played one full season in his career. Stories have really defined his career. And last year, even his breakout year, he missed the last game of the season because of a foot injury. So he's got to get over those injury concerns, you know, that injury bug that always continues to nag him throughout his career. Because, guys, after him, there's a lot of question marks, a lot of no-name players behind him on the depth chart.
Adam John, Chicago Sun-Times, covers the Bears. You mentioned in your first answer, Adam, that the Bears say goodbye to Matt Forte, their longtime running back, really was a fixture for them for a long time. They looked to Jeremy Langford out of Michigan State his second year, and then they drafted Jordan Howard out of Indiana this season, throwing Jacquizz Rodgers as a third down type of back. do you see a 50-50 split with Howard and Lankford? Does Fox want to ride one guy? I know in the past he's kind of done a running back by committee. What's your feel for how they're going to use these running backs?
Yeah, they're definitely going to have a running back committee. And I think, look, they want Lankford to be the more featured back of that committee, if you know what I'm saying. He'll get the bulk of the carries. He is the more well-rounded of their backfield. You know, he could do he had some drops last year, but he's still the best receiver. He's by far the fastest running back, the biggest game-breaker, game-changer to have in the backfield. But in terms of having someone that complements his speed very well, yes, you got Jordan Howard, who's a bruiser, 6 foot, 230 pounds. You also have Kadeem Carey, a draft pick from the old Phil Emery regime, who was one over John Fox with his hard-nosed, bulldozer-style running. Now, he's a lot smaller, by like 30 pounds smaller than a Jordan Howard, so there's some durability concerns. He also had a concussion last year. But his violent style, the way he lowers his head, lowers his shoulders, really has John Fox's love and attention right now. So I think he's in the mix to compete with Jordan Howard for those complimentary carries behind Lankford. I think Jaquizz Rodgers is actually on the roster bubble, but yes, he's a veteran. He can play in the special teams, but starts with Lankford, where if he could develop into a more complete back, where he could be out there for every down. And then you have Kadeem Carey, Jordan Howard, the rookie, competing for those more physical carries, you know, within the 10 and the goal line and whatnot.
Well, if they want to pound the football this coming season, Adam, you know they're going to need good play from the offensive line. And if you look in recent history, Bears' offensive line has been very erratic, very up and down. Part of that's because of injuries. It seems as if the theme this offseason, Adam, was the fact that they were parting ways with some of their veterans, like a Jermon Bushrod, a Matt Slauson. And if you look at the draft, bringing in some youth, Kyle Long is now going to go back to the guard spot. What's the overall direction of this offensive line? What's the upside in the group that currently is set to start the season?
I think overall they're more athletic. Whether that's a Cody White here, the second-round pick, who was arguably the best guard in this year's draft, replacing Matt Slauson in the left guard, whether it's getting Veronis Grassue, a third-round pick from a year ago, in his second season at center, you know, I think they're very high in Charles Leno. And I know a lot of, whether it's Pro Football Focus or other outsiders, they're very down on Charles Leno, but this is a guy, a left tackle who took over for an injured Jermon Bushrod last year, was a seventh-round pick out of Boise State. Not a lot of high expectations, and he became a pretty good starter last year. So held in that context, you can see some better things from Charles Leno this year. They signed Bobby Massey, which moved Kyle Long back to right guard. So that right side of the line seems pretty strong, especially in terms of running. But to go back to Kyle Long, I know we mentioned him briefly here. The Bears, probably the best move of their entire offseason was getting him back to his natural guard spot. I mean, where he's a complete mauler. Yes, he made the Pro Bowl as a right tackle last year in his first year. And I know there's some more value in having a left tackle, you know, right tackle, a tackle spot, and more valued by some teams. But he's an elite-level interior player, Kyle Long. If you get him back at right guard where he could be the bruiser, the mauler, the athletic, you know, a guy who you could pull in space and really get out and wreak some havoc on some of these, you know, outside linebackers and defensive tackles and linebackers and stuff, is such a gain for the Bears. And I don't think that move of getting him back to right guard should be overlooked. I think it might be their best move really all offseason.
You know, Adam, looking at this defense, you just look at the names and nobody jumps out at you. Then I looked at the rankings for the Bears last year on defense. They're around the middle of the league in terms of yards and points allowed. Actually, a little bit better than that. They were in the top half. You see a lot of veterans at linebacker, Pinnell McPhee, Jarrell Freeman, Trevathan, Lamar Houston, a lot of free agents they've brought in over the years. What's the strength of this defense? What's their identity? And are people impressed with the type of production John Fox was able to get out of this group last year? And what's the prognosis for this season for this defense?
Well, I think you should be very impressed by what John Fox, the defensive coordinator, Vic Fangio, did with. I mean, let's face it. You look at what they had on the roster last year. That's a lackluster group in so many regards. And for some weeks, you know, for a good bulk of the season, they were in the top 10 in total defense. Their passing defense was very good. I think it finished within the top 5, you know, with having, you know, some really no-name guys there in the secondary, other than like a Kyle Fuller, who was a first-round pick from a couple of years ago, and he was pretty up and down. So what they did with the talent they had was very impressive. The biggest difference for me will come at inside linebacker. Last year at this time, you had Shay McClellan and Christian Jones learning how to be inside linebackers in Vic Fangio's 3-4 defense. They signed Danny Trevathan and Jarrell Freeman this offseason to free agent contracts. They are significant upgrades in the middle of the Bears' defense, just from a production standpoint, from an experience standpoint, and just from an instinct standpoint and an athleticism standpoint. So those are major upgrades in the interior of the defense. I think Akeem Hicks in the front seven is an upgrade over Jarvis Jenkins, who was a starter in their 3-4 front last year. You have a Willie Young and a Lamar Houston who are healthy to start this offseason, as opposed to last year when they're coming off serious injuries. Yeah, Pernell McPhee coming back for a second year. He really changed the swagger and the vibe of that defense just with his no-nonsense mentality, his dog mentality, as he called it so often. So you got him coming back in a second year. I think the expectations of the Bears defense should be high. I think their front seven is very stout. You have some question marks in the back end, and Adrian Amos be a better playmaker at safety in year two there. Can Tracy Porter stay healthy? Can Kyle Fuller become more consistent? Who is your other starting safety? You got some concerns back there. But as a front seven, I think they're very potent. I think they got a lot of talent, a lot of speed, and I think they will be a much better defense than they were last year. And last year's group was pretty serviceable overall.
Yeah, impressive considering, as you mentioned, what Vic Fangio, the defensive coordinator, was working with. And Adam, you know, this is a copycat league, and I think back to Fangio's stint with the Niners. Last year was his first year as the defensive coordinator for the Bears, and, you know, the heart and soul of that Niners defense that he worked with was really the middle of the field, that linebacking core, the Patrick Willises, the Navarro Bowmans, even Chris Borland before he ultimately retired. So now that you look at this personnel grouping that they brought in through free agency in the draft, how much more does this mimic, perhaps, what Fangio was building in San Francisco? And do you think that that was the ultimate goal, to maybe after a year say, let's try to bring the identity over that worked in San Fran?
Yeah, those are some good points. Now, I'm not saying that Trevathan or Freeman could be, you know, your Willis or your Bowman. I mean, those are some special linebackers, right? But they're better than what the Bears had last year, and the Bears' defense wasn't awful last year. You know, again, they were pretty capable unit with having some guys learning a job. But I think just by adding the more experienced, the more athletic players, the more instinctual players in Trevathan and Freeman will be just an immediate upgrade, such a different feel for the defense just from day one from camp when they report next week, even this whole offseason. I mean, the defense looks like it's been playing together for a long time. Now they got to get the pads on and the offense will attack them differently. But you can see their experience, and it's a world of difference than what the Bears had last year. And you made a good point about going up the middle. That's why I got to point out Adrian Amos again, you know, and who are the other safeties. Can they really take, you know, the next step in their development? And I think the interior of the Bears' defensive line, you know, you want to compare it to what they had in San Francisco. They had, you know, the Justin Smiths of the world. I mean, you got Eddie Goldman, who was a pretty good rookie last year. He'll be in year two. Akeem Hicks is a much better player, again, than Jarvis Jenkins. And this is a guy that Bill Belichick tried so hard to keep. He made the final pitch to him, to Hicks, to try to keep him in New England. So, you know, he's a pretty darn good player, Bill Belichick, getting on the phone to try to keep him in New England. So just the interior of the defense, the front seven, there's a lot of positives looked at on this defense, you know, especially on paper when you want to compare it to last season.
And they added some talented players in the draft as well. Jonathan Bode, a late-round pick, but the guy I want to focus on is Leonard Floyd here, Adam. It seemed like it was the worst-kept secret in the league last year that the Giants would have loved to have Leonard Floyd at number 10. The Bears went and made sure that didn't happen. What have you seen from Floyd so far in the spring? Are the Bears just kind of, in his first year, going to use him as a situational pass rusher? How do you see Leonard Floyd being deployed by Chicago this year? And what have you seen from him in camp? Are the coaches happy with his early progress?
You know, he's definitely going to be a situational guy to begin with because, again, you got Lamar Houston, you got Willie Young, you got Pernell McPhee, Sam Acho, you know, another seasoned veteran with some special teams experience who could come in and run situations and stuff like that. So you have time to allow a Leonard Floyd to develop. Look, this is a guy, I mean, you guys know his story, played all sorts of positions at Georgia, had some low production, but he's a freak athlete. He's got these very long arms, and he's very fast. The big storyline here in Chicago was if Leonard Floyd can gain so much weight. You know, they wanted him to play in the 240s. But you know what? Vic Fangio, who is, in my eyes, one of the best defensive coordinators in this game, just basically shrugged it off, saying he is what he is, and we want him to maintain that speed. We don't want him to bulk up to 260 and become slower. Fangio felt that his outside pass rushers lacked speed last year overall. You have power in McPhee. You have power in Willie Young and Lamar Houston. Leonard Floyd will complement them very well with that speed factor. They want to make sure they maintain that speed. They want to enhance that speed. So that is their emphasis. They don't want to bulk him up too much because they don't want to lose his quick first step or any of that. So they're still working some power moves with him. They're working some counter moves. But the emphasis of him having just one position as opposed to so many at Georgia, they believe will help. And, again, they have time to let him grow.
Talking with Adam Johns, who covers the Bears for the Chicago Sun-Times. Now, Adam, you mentioned that their focus was obviously beefing up the front seven, because if you look at the numbers statistically last year, the Bears struggled to stop the run, yet they were respectable against the pass, and you highlighted some of the members in the safety core and so forth. They lost veterans like Antrell Roll, Ryan Mundy, trying to get a bit younger. But I'm curious, when you evaluate last season's defense, how impressive was the secondary? Or was it a matter of, hey, everybody goes up against the Bears, they're just running the ball down their throats, so it's really, truly hard to take away some substance from those numbers out of the secondary last season?
Yeah, I know. That's a good point, because a lot of teams just did straight pounded on them, but in some games they were actually pretty good against the run. I remember that they held Adrian Peterson in check late in the season. Now, of course, the success fluctuated. But if you want to look at any success in the secondary, to me, it was getting a shutdown guy, at least in Fangio's and Fox's eyes, and Tracy Porter. This guy was a journeyman, right? He had played in a few different spots, dealt with injuries, and he really came on as a playmaker in so many different ways for Fangio's defense. He got the top assignments as opposed to the young cornerback, Ty Fuller. I mean, he got the best receiver every game. He was their matchup guy. They brought him back, you know, with an incentive-laden deal. He's counted on to be a veteran voice in that secondary right now. Again, I think overall the scheme and not making things overly complex for these guys, and just how well coached they were by Vic Fangio and the secondary coach Ed Donatell and the other defensive assistants. I mean, that really was such a great story last year for a franchise that really prides itself on defense. I mean, this was a team in the Mark Trestman era had posted his two historically awful defense. I mean, the two worst defenses in history came in that Mark Trestman era.
Wow.
Vic Fangio comes in here and fields a respectable unit with a lot of the same players that were from that Trestman era. You know, a lot of new guys, you know, old faces and new spots, you know, just a remarkable job he did. And now they got some of their own guys in, you know, whether it's through the draft or some of the free agents they targeted. So, I think the defense is going to be a strength for the Bears, especially their front seven. But you mentioned the passing defense, and I think that it really goes back to Tracy Porter and the success he had last year and the Bears' willingness to give him a new contract this year. I mean, he's a difference maker for them in the secondary.
The NFC North, to me, Adam, might be sneakily the best division in football. You got a team like the Packers with Aaron Rodgers. I think the Vikings are only going to get better with their young defense and young quarterback. And then you have the Lions, who have a good quarterback in Stafford, and the Bears, who came on strong last year. That division, how do you see it? Is this going to be one of the best divisions in football this year?
You know what? I think there's some parity in the NFC North. That's what I think about the Lions. If the Lions were an elite, true competitor, and not just maybe an average team or worse, I don't think Calvin Johnson retires, right, fellas?
That's fair.
If they're making a playoff run, you know, I think he would have that extra motivation. The main question is about the Vikings. Does Teddy Bridgewater make that next step? I mean, how long can Adrian Peterson continue to be their workhorse back? I mean, they've added some nice weapons. You know, they've drafted Laquon Treadwell. You know, they got some weapons now. But Teddy Bridgewater, can he make that next step so he can have a more complete team with that good defense, Adrian Peterson, and some better weapons? I mean, it's on Teddy Bridgewater there. And then the Packers, I mean, last year was, by all accounts, Aaron Rodgers' worst season in his career, and he didn't even have that bad of a year, but he's just such a high bar for himself. I think they're pretty thin at receiver. We saw that with Jordy Nelson. I mean, if he has another injury, they're going to have some concerns there. I think there's some holes in their defense. Some of these teams can develop as some scary good teams, but I think there's also some parity where if the Bears do come together and Alshon Jeffrey and Kevin White do make a nice combo and Jeremy Langford comes down and Jay Cutler makes it next up where they could, you know, really threaten the Packers or the Vikings. There's that much positives right now with the Bears that they can do this. But at the same time, you know, if Teddy Bridgewater takes that next step and the Packers find some difference makers on defense, I mean, they could take it to the Bears just as well. So I think there's parity. There's a lot of talent across the board. We'll just see how it shakes out, guys. You know, there's always one team, you know, whether it's within a division or a conference that surprises you. And I'll be honest, I mean, it could be the Bears because, again, yep. I know Peyton Manning's not coming here. John Fox is known for his turnaround.
Well, Jake Cutler has fooled a lot of teams before. Maybe this time it's for real. We'll find out. Adam, we appreciate it. Thanks so much for the time, and we'll see you on November 20th here at MetLife Stadium.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Sounds good, fellas. Take care.
You got it.
That's Adam Johns from the Chicago Sun-Times. Excellent work out of him. And now we turn our attention to the next team on the Giants' schedule. They take on the Cleveland Browns. It's their first road game after three straight home games coming off their bye. And to talk about the Cleveland Browns is Aaron Goldhammer from WKNR, does pre- and post-game on the Browns radio network, also a former college friend of Lance and I. In fact, he was Lance's roommate.
Indeed.
And we will get to that at some point during this interview, I promise you that. Well, Hammer, I guess I'll start with this. Good thing the Cavs won the championship this year, because this is going to be one hell of a long Brown season.
Well, guys, I was going to say, having lived with Lance, there might be a point of the year when we need Lance to come play quarterback for the Browns.
I'm ready. I'm warming up the arm, Hammer.
Guys, you know, the Browns are in the middle of a rebuild, and I think there are a few ways to approach and look at what they've got going on. I mean, I think they finally found their head coach. I hear great things about Hugh Jackson. He's very well respected around the league and by the players. And I think he's off to a good start. You know, it's tough to judge a coach who hasn't really coached a game yet for your team, but I think everybody feels good about that. They remade the front office. They're going to an analytics-heavy football, money ball approach. And then, you know, their roster just has huge question marks all over it. So, you know, I think if you're expecting the Browns to compete for the division or a playoff spot this year, you got another thing coming. But I think the hope, John, is that they're better at the end of the year than they were at the beginning of the year. Brown seasons have a way of devolving, and the hope is that this year the rookies, the young players, that they improve and position themselves to maybe find a franchise quarterback and really get things moving in the right direction 2017.
Aaron, you alluded to the fact that the top of the front office has changed. They call them Team Harvard, those three executives who all came from Harvard, more of an analytical style. And Hugh Jackson, the new head coach, since you've been in Cleveland, there's probably been more coaches that have run the Browns than politicians at the Republican convention where you're at, I would assume. But in all seriousness, you know, how has the culture changed from what you've seen around the franchise? Meaning, is there a different feel now that Hugh Jackson is running the franchise, given the stability that he's brought to other teams compared to the previous regimes?
Lance, I think so. And I think that's the reason that some fans are optimistic. It's not just that Hugh is in. It's also that Johnny Manziel is out, guys. You know, that's a guy who provided a ton of instability, who divided the locker room and the front office and really messed up the organization for a couple of years. So the day they made that decision back in March, I think they were starting to move in the right direction. As far as that's concerned. The front office side of things, though, is interesting. You know, I think really they're going to have to prove it. They're going to have to prove that they can get draft picks right and really make the smart football decisions. They all got really good SAT scores, but getting the first or second pick in the NFL draft right and getting questions right, the verbal section, are two very different things. So I think how the power breakdown and stability and all that goes, I think is going to be, for the front office standpoint, determined on whether or not they actually come out and nail the picks. But as I said, Hugh Jackson, the coach, is very well respected. I mean, the Giants wanted to interview Hugh Jackson
yep.
when they had their opening this past offseason, remember, And the Browns, like, locked him in the building and wouldn't let him get on the plane to even go to that interview. So there were other teams that wanted him. I think he was one of the top available candidates on the market. I don't want to make him out like he's Bill Belichick, because he's not yet, but I feel a heck of a lot better with him at the helm than I would Mike Pettine or Rob Chudzinski or the people that have been here before.
And he's known as a bit of a quarterback guru, Hammer, so he better have his guruing skills out for this group. And I'm going to ask you a question that's tougher than any SAT question those guys from Harvard got right. Who's going to be quarterbacking the Browns and the Giants play them on November 27th?
Yeah, I mean, it could be any of three or four guys. I mean, Robert Griffin III, guys, is the biggest question on the Browns this year. If they got that signing right, it will really expedite the rebuilding process for them. If he reverts back to 2012 form, RG3 is going to be playing, John, and this might be a fun game to watch. But I'm worried about injuries. I'm worried about him breaking down and not being able to execute the Browns' offense. There are already rumors that Josh McCown is performing better in the OTAs and the minicamps than RG3 was. So I think there's a chance that McCown could be playing in that game. McCown also can't stay healthy. And you know the Browns, they'll run through three, four, five quarterbacks in a season like nothing. So I'd keep an eye on Cody Kessler, who's the Browns' rookie third-round pick. A lot of people thought he was overdrafted out of USC. And then they still have the legendary Austin Davis sitting down there on the bench, and I wouldn't rule him out for that spot either.
I have two quick quarterback follow-ups, however, before we move on to some other spots here. When they decide who's going to start, are they going to start the guy who they think can win them the most games, or are they going to start the quarterback that they believe has the best chance of developing into something down the road as a long-term answer? And as a follow-up to that, at what point did they start regretting not taking one of the two quarterbacks that were available in this year's draft when they traded down?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, John. I think your first question, they're probably going to start RG3 at the beginning because that's what they signed him to do, and that was Hugh Jackson's call. He is a quarterback guru. He is quarterback whisperer. Okay, if you really think you're that smart, Hugh, and you think you're that good, fix what has ailed Robert Griffin III for the last three or four years. Gruden tried, couldn't do it. Shanahan tried, couldn't do it. Now it's on you to see if you can make something of the former Heisman Trophy winner and number two overall pick. So it has not gone great at the start, but it's still really early to try to make any definitive thoughts on how that's going. We'll probably know more in a few weeks when we get a few preseason games under our belt. As far as Griffin is concerned, I think, though, as the year goes on, if it falls apart the way many Browns seasons do, people are going to want to see what the Browns have in Cody Kessler, their third-round pick. Personally, to me, I would have preferred them to either trade up and take Jared Goff at one, like the Rams did, or to stay at two and take Carson Wentz. The first big move this front office made was trading down and amassing those picks. If Carson Wentz turns out to be a really good player and they whiff on all the draft picks they acquired, we're going to be sitting right back here talking about another new Browns front office. It was a bold move to go anti-quarterback in this day and age, and that's what the Browns did. And I think we're going to be back here next year, guys, talking again about who's the Browns quarterback of the future going to be, who's their next franchise guy. It's the biggest unanswered question in the history of Cleveland sports, and I think these guys have done nothing yet to answer that question.
Talking with Aaron Goldhammer, ESPN Radio and Cleveland Browns Radio Network, as we continue to preview the Giants' upcoming opponents this season. Aaron, you laid out everybody who's in the mix at the quarterback position, and regardless who wins the ultimate starting job, it really is going to come down to how the offensive line performs. And there's been a lot of turnover on the offensive line this offseason. Most notably, the Browns lose multiple Pro Bowler Alex Mack. They also lose Mitchell Schwartz in free agency, who was one of the highest-rated right tackles last season. You know, how does this offensive line look right now? And if it is an issue, which quarterback would be best suitable for those circumstances, considering, as you know, Aaron, when RG3 struggled in Washington, a big part of that was the offensive line, which was very inconsistent.
Yeah. Well, Lance, as you know, quarterbacks are victims or beneficiaries of the players around them.
Indeed.
And You know, the line is going to be a question. I mean, they lose really two Pro Bowl level players to free agency in Alex Mack, who went to Atlanta. Mitchell Schwartz is in Kansas City. That's a center and a right tackle that you have to replace. They drafted guys that they think are going to fill those roles. Sean Coleman is a rookie from Auburn. They expect him to fill in at right tackle. Cameron Irving is their number one pick from last year, who they're expecting to play center. And man, oh man, did he have a brutal rookie year. So I think the line, even though they have Joe Thomas on the left side, who might be the best lineman in all of football, I think the line is a major question. I think it's one of the reasons they liked Griffin, actually, Lance, as crazy as that sounds, because they think that he'll be able to use his legs to make some plays, and he may not need the same level of protection as a traditional drop-back passer. I think the line is going to be a problem, though. I think it's an area of need. I think it's worse than last year, and last year's team went 3-13 and got quarterbacks injured, so that's a little bit alarming. The one last thing I would say about the Browns' offensive line is, if they're really rebuilding, guys, paying a lot of money to a 30-some-year-old Joe Thomas probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I would keep my eye on the trade deadline again this year. He was rumored last year to go to Denver, amongst other places. I think he could be made available again in the right deal if it comes about a few weeks into the year.
That'll make some Giant fans lick their lips who've been looking for another offensive tackle. Real quick on the offense before we switch to the defense quickly, Hammer. Quarterbacks also need skill position guys to help Matt a little bit. Who the heck is he handing the ball off to? Can Duke Johnson be an every down back? Is he big enough? And who the heck is he throwing the ball to? You drafted Corey Coleman, then you got a bunch of guys here besides Andy Hawkins I've never heard of.
Yeah, I mean, the running back situation has become an even bigger question mark in the last week, guys, because Isaiah Crowell posted some really awful, inappropriate things about, you know, the recent social issues we've been having relationship between, you know, between citizens and police officers that really was eye-opening and opened up a really interesting conversation in Cleveland, but really put Isaiah in a bad spot. So he was going to be their starting running back, but I think he now has a real uphill battle to make the roster in light of those things that are going on with him off the field. And then you have Duke Johnson, who had a pretty solid rookie year. He was the AFC North Rookie of the Year last year. So if you're looking in fantasy to pick up a Browns running back, I think that's the guy. And then there's a player named Terrence Watson, who Hugh Jackson brought in from Cincinnati, who I know he likes a lot, who I would expect to make the team. That's the running back situation. The receiver thing, again, quarterbacks are the victims or beneficiaries of the players around them. There's no Odell Beckham Jr. on this roster. Okay, they like Corey Coleman a lot. He's young and has never played a down in the NFL before, and he's probably the number one guy. Behind him, Hawkins and Gabriel are the veterans. They cut Brian Hartline. Dwayne Bowe had an awful year in Cleveland. It hardly played and now is gone. So it's really a bunch of rookies. They have a guy from Colorado State named Hollywood Higgins that they like a lot. I mean, there really is not much there. Gary Barnage is their best pass-catching threat. He's the tight end. And then I think there are still some amongst the fan base, at least, that are holding out hope that when Josh Gordon has the opportunity to apply for reinstatement again on August 1st, that something could happen with him in the league and that maybe he would somehow get reinstated in play. But guys, if you're counting on Josh Gordon to pass drug tests, good luck.
Yeah, and I did read that. I believe August 1st is perhaps when he may be reinstated, but that's still very much up in the air, as you mentioned, in terms of his status. Defense, there was just as much turnover, Hammer, as there was on offense. They lost a few veteran safeties that they chose not to re-sign because, as you mentioned, they're going in a younger direction. Carlos Dansby at the linebacker position. When you look at the makeup of this defense right now, one, what is the main strength? And where do you think they're going in terms of the overall makeup of this defense? Is this a youth movement, or, you know, are they wanting to have some balance between the veterans and the young guys?
Well, the new coordinator, Ray Horton, always has focused on the secondary and the pass rush. So I think those are the places where the Browns want to be better. I do think they made some good draft picks on defense. I would watch Emmanuel Ogba, their second-round pick, and Carl Nassib, their third-round pick, out of Oklahoma State and Penn State, respectively. Those were two of the top sackers in all of college football last year, and they expect them to come to the NFL and produce. The pass rush lost a huge piece when Desmond Bryant went down for the year last week with a pectoral tear, lifting weights in the offseason. That's going to be a significant blow for them, but they really need their secondary to step up and play better than they did last year. Joe Hayden had a miserable year. He's got to bounce back. He's a Pro Bowl level player. And then, you know, elsewhere, they've got Jamon Williams as their other corner. I mean, you might consider that as the strength of the defense up to this point. But, again, it's another area where they're rebuilding, and they need some young guys to step up. They're going to be playing a lot of rookies. They're probably not going to play well early in the season. And the hope is, as the year goes on, they'll learn and they'll be better in December than they were in September. I think the coordinator and the coaching will be much better. Jim O'Neill was the defensive coordinator last year. He's now in San Francisco. Did a terrible job with this defense. They were dead last against the run last year. And, you know, they have to make small strides. I would not expect this to be the 85 Bears playing defense for the Browns either this year, guys.
And I'm sure they'd like more production out of second-year Danny Shelton, the big guy in the middle, Paul Kruger, a disappointing free agent addition. They'll try to get more out of those guys. But we're joined by Aaron Goldhammer. Cleveland Browns, pre and post, WKNR ESPN Radio in Cleveland. Enough of breaking down the Browns. Let's break down Lance Meadow, the collegiate roommate hammer. Give the Giant fans out there that are listening that want to give Lance a hard time some ammunition for what Lance was like as a college roommate at NYU in the early 2000s.
I mean, where do I even start? Like, first of all, to tell you how long ago we were in college, he was like videotaping episodes of One Tree Hill on the
You know, I knew that was going to come up. Oh, boy.
None of those things even exist anymore.
Yeah, we're getting old. The gray hairs are accumulating. Yep.
I know. But I got to say, Lance was very clean. He was very civil. And he was a great roommate, in part because he went home to Brooklyn every weekend, which meant I had my run of
the
room.
There you go.
If only the walls could talk, Lance, what happened when he disappeared.
I can only imagine what I missed out on. Or maybe I'm happy that I wasn't there anyway. So
there you go. I think Schmuck, that's the best I can do.
Very good. Hammer, great stuff. Stay safe with the convention. Enjoy it as much as you can. And we'll talk to you when we get closer to the game in November. Right, pal?
Yeah, my best advice for Browns fans this year, keep Game 7 of the NBA Finals on DVR because there are going to be second halves where you're going to want to watch something better than what's happening on football.
By the way, out of curiosity, is the euphoria from the Cavs title still there? I visited you in Cleveland a few weeks ago, and everyone was wearing their Cavalier championship shirts. Has that gone away, or are people still flying high?
We hadn't won a title in 52 years. There are people who are still at a party. No, come on.
Hammer, has J.R. Smith
throwing another parade?
Has J.R. Smith put on his shirt yet? Any word? Do we have an update?
No.
No? Okay.
No. We played a pickup game, and he was skinned.
He was still skinned. Okay.
I heard he wants about 15 mil a year, though. How's that going to work out?
Yeah, that's going to be a little dicey. I have a feeling that'll stretch into September. No one will sign him for that, and then he'll sign a contract for less. But I wouldn't expect resolution on that anytime soon.
Well, on the bright side for Browns fans, they got the Cavs euphoria. Hopefully the Indians will have a long playoff run in Major League Baseball. I'll give you guys something to talk about, Hammer. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you in November, pal.
Thanks, Hammer.
Thanks, guys.
So I think now the question is, Lance, we know what it was like to live with Lance Meadow. What was it like to live with Aaron Goldhammer?
Well, I think that it was just as comfortable as I would assume he found living with me. You know, he kept to his side of the room. I kept to my side of the room. We had a line right down the middle, and everybody respected one another.
Have you transferred your One Tree Hill VHS tapes to DVD?
Well, I never had the whole set.
Okay.
The conversion program broke down midway between college and the professional career.
I see.
Time wasn't providing the ideal flexibility for that. But on the internet now, thankfully, they have full archives to peruse.
Still a fan?
Absolutely. We'll leave it at that. We won't get into any more details.
No,
I can only allow you to use so much material against
that
me.
That is absolutely correct. All right, everybody. That's it for Big Blue Kickoff Week. Big Blue Kickoff Live, excuse me, for this week. We'll be back on Monday. The office is closed tomorrow. That is the last Friday it's closed. And from here on out, it'll be Monday through Friday every day, except for national holidays, of course, for Big Blue Kickoff Live on Giants.com. On Monday, it will be Lance Meadow and I, we're going to preview the Giants matchup against the Pittsburgh Steelers. We'll have some fun with you and take your calls. Hopefully, we'll be back on camera at some point next week heading into training
it's a guessing
camp.
Game.
The plans are in the works. That's all I can say. And then you can see Lance Meadow's handsome face once again. And I know you can't wait.
Well, it should only be penciled into everybody's schedule, that.
Absolutely.
Because life isn't complete without that.
For Lance Meadow, I'm John Schmelk. Have a great weekend. And thanks for joining us on Big Blue Kickoff Live on Giants.com. .com.